From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump said yesterday he was happy to report a ceasefire with Turkey. But today, Turkey's president threatened to ramp up military campaigns in northern Syria if that agreement isn't upheld. And there are reports of sporadic shelling and gunfire there despite the agreement. That ceasefire was brokered by Vice President Mike Pence after Turkey invaded Syria following President Trump's sudden decision to pull American troops out of the northern part of the country. Joining us now to break all of this down is Borzu Daragahi, international correspondent for the UK's Independent. He's in Istanbul. And Borzu, there has been a lot of disagreement about how the ceasefire should work. Can you tell us about what you know and what's happening on the ground?
What I know is every single party is sort of spinning it their way. I was just actually in a press briefing with the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and you know he was basically saying that they got everything they wanted from the Americans and that they will not pursue offensive operations for 120 hours to see if the Kurdish forces vacate certain areas. The SDF, the Kurdish-led forces that are in northeast Syria, have their kind of spin on it, saying that, you know, we're, you know, signing on to a cessation of hostilities and, you know, we're trying to protect our people. There will be no movement of people. I'm not sure if that means that they're going to, you know, just take their uniforms off and just remain in place and say we're no longer the SDF. And, you know, the Americans are hailing it as this great international accomplishment. On the ground, what it's meant so far is not much. I'm not at the border now, but I was until a couple days ago, and it was just ferocious fighting. And it, according to people that I'm talking to, it continues to be just as ferocious, maybe not airstrikes from the Turkish forces, but definitely rocket, small arms, heavy machine gun fire near constantly as Turkey's allies, the Syrian National Army, former amalgam of Syrian rebel groups, fights against the remnants of the YPG in certain areas.
I want to talk a little bit more about these Kurdish forces. You said many of them say they will just stay there. But if they vacate the area, as this agreement has been pushing them to, where will they go?
Further inland. The idea is that the YPG, the Kurdish-led force that is a cousin of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which has been at war for 40 years, they will move further south of a 32-kilometer or 20-mile or so buffer zone that Turkey wants established, a sort of safe zone. And they will, you know, move their heavy weaponry and personnel south of that area.
Okay. As you said, everyone is spinning this in their favor, but I'm thinking about the winners and losers in all of this and breaking down the agreement. It seems like a big win for Turkey. The foreign minister there said, we got what we wanted. How does this agreement benefit Turkey?
I mean, this is a huge victory for Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He got the Trump administration to endorse a plan that he's had for 4 years. He's wanted this buffer zone, and he finally got the U.S. to sign on to it. Just the fact that the U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo came to Turkey almost kind of groveling to Erdogan to get this deal is a huge deal for them. The fact that they managed to help President Trump and save him from domestic political turmoil, he owes them at this point. And as one of my editors pointed out, it's like another foreign policy quid pro quo for the Trump administration. You get your safe zone. I get Pat Robertson to stop yelling at me about abandoning the Kurds.
Borzu, I want to ask you about Russia and Iran. How does this agreement benefit them?
I think it definitely benefits Russia. It emerges as the undisputed kingmaker in Syria, and Putin has managed to get on the good side of the Syrian regime, the good side of the Iranian regime, and the good side of the Turkish regime. And, you know, that is a huge advantage for Vladimir Putin. Everyone is going to Sochi on Tuesday, the Russian resort town, where they're going to, you know, continue to sort out the future of Syria. That's Tehran, Ankara and Moscow without the U.S. involved at all.
Which really brings up for everyone, really the U.S. reputation overall and the scope of influence. This actually, what does this say about U.S.'s reputation overall?
Well, let's be candid here. The U.S. doesn't have the most stellar reputation in this part of the world. But, you know, I think that people are watching the Trump show very, very closely from abroad. They're watching this kind of car wreck unfold with a mixture of fascination and, you know, humor as well. People are laughing about it, but they're also looking at ways to game it. And I think that, you know, countries from Turkey to, you know, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, they're all watching, but they're also kind of trying to figure out ways that they can manipulate the situation for their advantage, knowing that this is a kind of temporary opportunity where a wounded, weakened president, cornered, can do things to their advantage based on like a chummy phone call on a Sunday evening.
Borzu Daragahi, international correspondent for The Independent, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And during a meeting earlier this week about his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, President Trump took a swipe at his former defense secretary, James Mattis, calling him the world's most overrated general. Mattis countered last night.
He also called Meryl Streep an overrated actress. So I guess I'm the Meryl Streep of generals. And frankly, that sounds pretty good to me.
Mattis was at a charity dinner in New York, and his words have been making the rounds on social media. So why don't we check in with Femi Ok? She's the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Peter. So many zingers in that speech. The internet loved it. I have never known the general to be that funny in person, but people were really enjoying the zingers. And when I woke up this morning, there were two things that's very strange to see, which was that James Mattis and Meryl Streep together, they were connected together, were actually trending. And then as soon as we heard that cut from that little clip there from his speech, we understood exactly why. People were enjoying this immensely. Priya, for instance, was saying, now that's a roast. Keep them coming, sir. Lots of memes and references to shade. And then also some more serious comments. This one is from Dr. G, because people are remembering that this is a former defense secretary. So Dr. G was saying that innocent people are getting killed in Syria, the time for jovial banter is behind us. Mm-hmm. And I do suggest that you listen to all the zingers. For instance, I used to be called Mad Dog and now I'm more of an emotional support dog. There's some really nice, funny lines in there. But then James Mattis then goes on to talk about some serious issues about America, the world, getting together as a nation, and also telling some war stories from Iraq. It's 16 minutes long. Look for it online. Worth your time.
You make a good point. Mattis quit over the president's choice to draw down U.S. troops in Syria, so we should remember that. On to a different subject. It was a historic day, Femi, above our heads. Let's listen.
The amazing view out here is phenomenal.
It's an amazing view out here. NASA astronauts Christina Cook and Jessica Meir replacing a power controller today outside the International Space Station. It was the first all-woman spacewalk in history, Femi.
History. People are loving this online. And NASA is so good at communicating, at being accessible, using social media. They are, let me tell you how bold they are, not just in the way that they use their space adventures and get all of us as a public generally interested in it. They are in the comments section of YouTube watching the spacewalk live. If you've ever been in a YouTube comment section, you know that is a dangerous place to be. But NASA is there answering questions. People are saying, well, do you have an emergency procedure? And they're literally talking back to everybody who's viewing and watching the spacewalk, saying yes. There's a hashtag that is trending right now, which is Ask NASA. So kids big and small can ask NASA various different questions. For instance, Elizabeth says, how long can you be outside the space station? The International Space Station replies, the longest spacewalk lasted 8 hours and 56 minutes and took place in 2001 with NASA astronauts James Voss and Susan Helms. If you have a question that you want to ask about this all-women spacewalk, hashtag Ask NASA, you may well get an answer.
The backstory here is that NASA wanted to do this in the spring, but they got delayed because they didn't have enough spacesuits that would fit the women. So it's smart of them to do this sort of interactive PR campaign because they suffered a little bit last time. Now, speaking of strong women, Femi, so much Lady Gaga news this week, I don't know where to start.
It's not unusual for Lady Gaga to have viral moments, but she had two this week. So the first one was about a video game called Fortnite, and Lady Gaga just said, "What is Fortnite?"
Now, oh, come on, she knew, didn't she?
Well, she also spelled it slightly differently, so people were saying, well, it's 2 weeks, and it's something that the British often talk about. You know, you speak about a week, that is a week. 2 weeks together, that right. is a fortnight. I don't think she meant that.
No, the video
game,
come on.
I think she was teasing about the video game. And then it set out a huge conversation. All her little monsters, her fans came out. People who love video games came out. People who hate Fortnite came out. There were sub-conversations and discussions. And just when we thought we couldn't have any more conversation about a Lady Gaga to were tweet. Then in concert, a fan jumped on stage. She invited him on stage. They started dancing. The fan picked up Lady Gaga, and Lady Gaga and the fan fell off stage. Second viral moment of the week, Lady Gaga. But of course, she was very kind, and
the
fans
fine.
Loved her.
She was
kind
fine.
And beautiful.
She told the fan not to. Don't worry about it. It's not your fault. I don't know whose fault it was if it wasn't his. But anyways, he'll remember that for the rest of his life. Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome, Peter.
It's here and now.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
The e-cigarette maker Juul said yesterday that it will stop selling flavored e-cigarettes online. The company has already pulled them from stores as the number of vaping-related illnesses continues to rise. And now there's a new battle ahead for the industry. Lawmakers are trying to regulate the high level of nicotine in e-cigarettes. Dr. Ann Melzer is a pulmonary physician and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first, your response to Juul's decision to now suspend all sales of flavored e-cigarettes. Is that a meaningful move?
I think it is. I think there's a lot of evidence that the flavoring is a lot of what is drawing the youth into the market. And the flavoring is likely to contribute to some of the long-term health effects of e-cigarettes. And so I think that is potentially a helpful move for our youth.
One of the other issues that public health officials are pointing to, which also plays a role, they say, in getting kids addicted, is the high level of nicotine that's in e-cigarettes. Is that as much of a problem as these flavors? And can you explain how that works?
So they're both a big problem. The nicotine, however, is what makes them so addictive. And e-cigarettes are an extremely efficient way to deliver high doses of nicotine. And one thing we do have to keep in mind is that the concentration of the nicotine is only part of how much nicotine gets into the user. The devices themselves can be changed and tweaked and modified to deliver larger and larger quantities of vapor. And so really, what's the most concerning is how much nicotine is coming out per puff from these devices.
Can we talk about that? Because there are some numbers out that are kind of remarkable. A typical Juul pod, for instance, has 59 milligrams per milliliter. Compare that to a traditional cigarette with an average of 12 milligrams. So there's a huge difference there.
In a conventional cigarette, a lot of that nicotine is burned away as the cigarette combusts. And so we think about 1 or 2 milligrams of nicotine actually make it into a smoker per cigarette, and that can vary. With e-cigarettes, the user controls when the cigarette is on, and the way the vapor gets delivered, potentially more of that nicotine is actually absorbed by the user. And so we think, allowing for some losses, a user vaping an entire Juul pod is probably exposed to the same amount of nicotine as a smoker smoking a whole pack of cigarettes. If you measure how much long-term nicotine metabolite is present in someone who's vaping frequently, it can be even higher than the levels we see in someone who smokes, say, a pack of cigarettes a day.
Okay, so there's a new law that was proposed this month in the House of Representatives that would cap nicotine content at 20 milligrams per milliliter. And by the way, the Europeans have this cap already. Will this make a difference, do you think? Is that a meaningful piece of legislation?
I think that piece of legislation is a good first step. It's also worth keeping in mind that these high nicotine concentrations are a pretty recent development in e-cigarettes. Until recently, most e-cigarettes had significantly less than 20 milligrams per milliliter, and of course were still popular and being used by adult smokers. So I think next steps in terms of legislation need to consider the actual nicotine output of an individual device and an individual nicotine-containing liquid.
Well, the president of the American Vaping Association about this law said that we should not forget, his words, about the lives of adult ex-smokers who rely on high nicotine products to stay smoke-free. So that's the line from the industry. Dr. Ann Melzer, a pulmonary and critical care physician and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So nicotine can be hard to quit, but marijuana can be too. Nick Masitti was a proud pothead for decades. That is, until he tried to stop and couldn't. Here's his story.
This is Drummer's Grove in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, New York. It's right by my house, and I used to come here a lot until I quit smoking marijuana. Drum circles and pot are frequent companions. But here's the thing about the city these days. Weed is everywhere. I smell it all the time. Sometimes it's no big deal, and sometimes it's triggering, because I'm an addict, addicted to weed. You might not take that seriously, but I'm going to make the case that you should. A quick recap. Had a big heartbreak in high school? Weed helped. Dropped out of college? Weed helped. Arrested for dealing? Smoked before court. Got a slap on the wrist? Celebrated with a joint. Crashed my car, broke my neck, and tossed the weed out the window. None of that made me want to quit. Then, one day, years later, I realized I was paranoid all the time, rushing home every night after work to smoke alone. I tried to stop, but I couldn't. Cold turkey didn't work, therapy didn't help, neither did antidepressants, and every time I thought about checking out a recovery program, I think of Half-Baked, that cult stoner flick starring comedian Dave Chappelle. His character is a pothead, and he tries to quit smoking, too.
My name is Thurgood.
Hi, Thurgood.
He's standing on a stage, addressing all the other addicts.
I'm here today because I'm addicted to marijuana.
You in here for some marijuana? Marijuana?
Marijuana is not a drug.
Boo this man!
Funny, yeah. But some experts aren't laughing.
My name is Mark Kleiman. I'm a policy analyst by training. I run the crime and justice program at the NYU Mellon Institute.
Mark works at New York University. He's written a few books on marijuana policy in the U.S.
How many people like me are there? How many people are there, do we know, that identify as potheads who want to stop?
Something like 4 million. And yeah, it looks like about a third of the people who use every day or almost every day meet the diagnostic criteria for cannabis use disorder.
The criteria, according to Kleiman? Trying to cut back and failing. Knowing marijuana is messing with your life goals and still getting high all the same. Kleiman says there's a growing number of people in the U.S. like me, people who want to cut down or stop using pot altogether. He thinks maybe it's because the weed itself is more potent now. These days, anything less than 15% THC is considered low-potency weed, and it doesn't sell. Back in the 1970s, it was 3 to 6% THC. THC is the chemical we associate with the heady high feeling. But that lower amount was harder to get addicted to. Kleiman says about 30 years ago, when researchers looked at people who had said they used marijuana in the past month, 11% of them were daily users. Today, Mark says that number is around 35%.
Again, about a third of them report the symptoms of cannabis use disorder. And those heavy users account for about 85% of the weed consumed.
One of these things that I encounter all the time are people who like to tell me that I can't be an addict. What do I say to these people?
I mean, I know what I'd say to them, but I can't say it on the air.
I talked to Dr. J. Michael Bostwick. He's a professor of psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic who specializes in addiction counseling. I told him the same thing, how people say you can't get addicted to weed.
That is complete garbage. But again, if you go with the definition that there's a problem as a result of your use, whether you're meeting your goals as a family member or as a parent or as a spouse, as an adult, or whether potentially your substance use is interfering with your progress, then it doesn't much matter what other people say.
So I tell him about how I started breaking promises to myself, smoking earlier and earlier every day, for example.
Since it is psychoactive, I would say that you probably liked the way that it made you feel, and on one level wanted to feel that way all the time, but on the other level may have felt, I don't know, you'll have to speak to this, uncomfortable when you weren't high when you got up in the morning.
I did feel that way, and as it went on, I began to feel more and more uncomfortable all the time.
And you probably increased the amount that you were taking in.
I sure did.
Which is almost an exact description of any kind of addictive substance or practice.
Anyway, that's how smoking every day made me feel. But I also wanted to know what using pot daily was doing to my brain. So for that, I reached out to Susan Weiss, a psychologist and senior science advisor at the National Institute of Drug Abuse.
Cannabis is a very interesting drug because there is an entire signaling system called the endocannabinoid system.
Weiss told me this system runs through different parts of your brain and body. There's
the hippocampus, which is an area of the brain that's important for memory, and we know that marijuana impairs memory.
And there's also
the cortical areas, which have to do with judgment and sensory areas, so people may find that things taste different or better.
I didn't know it, but I was futzing with this entire system multiple times a day.
And when you do that, if you do it repeatedly, then the system itself will start to downregulate, which means it starts to become less sensitive. And that's how addiction starts to develop.
So these experts all tell me the addiction can be real. At the same time, legalization is on the march. So I took my concerns to people who argue for legalization. I expected them to be like, hey, relax, it's just a plant. But what they said surprised me.
Normal's not here to make the case that cannabis is somehow harmless or innocuous, because it isn't.
That's Paul Armentano. He's the deputy director of NORML, a pro-legalization group.
The fact is, if we are going to acknowledge that cannabis poses some potential risks, then it only follows that those risks are best mitigated by legalization, regulation, and public education.
To avoid those risks, I finally quit smoking pot back in 2014. I found a support group for people like me, people addicted to marijuana. No one tried to tell me weed wasn't a drug or that I wasn't an addict. Instead, I heard stories like mine. It may not work for everyone, but sharing, listening, it all helps me stay sober.
That was Nick Macitti, an audio engineer and podcast producer in Brooklyn, New York.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The first federal trial over who is at fault for the opioid epidemic is scheduled to start Monday in Cleveland. The country's three top drug distributors and a manufacturer are defendants. The case was brought by two Ohio counties. It's one of thousands of similar lawsuits from other states and local governments. And the trial date has added urgency in efforts to reach a larger settlement to resolve thousands of opioid lawsuits across the country. Nick Castell from member station WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland joins us now. Hi, Nick.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. First of all, let's talk a little bit about this trial. This one in particular is being watched very closely. It's seen as a bellwether. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, so these are the very first claims from a much larger group of lawsuits brought by counties, cities, Native American tribes across the country. These will be the first claims to see a jury. This is what's called a bellwether trial. So the outcome of this trial, if we actually go ahead and see one go to a verdict, the outcome of this trial could put even greater pressure on drug companies to settle, or it at least would show us what claims they may be held liable for if this litigation continues.
And let's talk a little bit about these drug companies, who they are, and the accusations against them.
Sure. So left in the case so far are, as you said, some of the major distributors like McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health. Teva Pharmaceutical is a manufacturer that's still in the case. These local governments across the country are accusing the drug industry of aggressive marketing that downplayed the addictive risk of opioid painkillers. They're accusing distributors of failing to control suspicious orders of pills that led to what's known as diversion, where pills were used for illicit purposes and contributed to this overall addiction crisis that has then led to millions upon millions, if not billions of dollars in damages across the country from local governments trying to respond to overdose deaths, trying to handle an increase in drug cases, an increase in drug use that's led to, you know, overcrowding at jails, a whole host of local government services that they say have been impacted by opioid use across the country.
Yeah, and this particular trial involves two Ohio counties, as I mentioned. But there are also ongoing negotiations over this larger settlement that you mentioned that would settle thousands of these cases. What do we know more about that particular settlement?
So this week there have been news reports basically sharing the outlines of what may be a global settlement involving some of the distributors and some of the plaintiffs. Now, there are many, many plaintiffs in this case, not just local governments, but also state attorneys general across the country who are not parties in this federal case. Reports have said that today representatives of both plaintiffs and defendants are meeting in Cleveland to continue their negotiations. If this results in global settlements with the remaining defendants in the case, and if the attorneys for the plaintiff, local governments, agree to it, it could avoid this trial that's scheduled to begin Monday. We haven't really seen any reports yet today about what might be agreed to and if it is palatable to the parties involved. So we'll have to keep our eye on that and see what happens later today.
Nick Castell, he is with member station WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And let's check in now on Venezuela. It's been 9 months since the contentious presidential election there, when longtime President Nicolas Maduro was sworn into office, even though Congress recognized his opponent Juan Guaido as the interim leader. Since then, U.S. sanctions and crumbling oil infrastructure has driven the country further into crisis. Up to 5 million Venezuelans have left the country. It's the worst migrant exodus the Western Hemisphere has ever seen. And yet, there are some 29 million people who still live there. We want to get a sense of how they are doing. So let's bring in Emeliana Duarte, is one of the people who still call Venezuela home. She's a freelance journalist, a Maduro critic, and currently working on a documentary about Venezuela's mass exodus called Time to Go. Emeliana, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
From where we sit, making sense of Venezuela can be really hard. We understand that inflation, which is in the six digits, means that a carton of eggs, as you write, can cost more than the monthly minimum salary. I mean, it really begs the question, how is it even possible for anyone to remain in the country at all?
Yes, Venezuela is a country rife with distortions and contradictions, and it's even hard for us down here in Venezuela to make sense of daily life. That said, the crisis has shifted and manifested in different ways. It used to be last year that the main concern with daily life was the mass shortages of goods. You could basically not find anything in the supermarket. And nowadays, supermarket shelves are once again lined with products, but they've become prohibitively expensive. Prices are rising every day, sometimes even twice a day. Sometimes you'll go to the supermarket in the morning, and by the time you come around in the afternoon, prices will have increased on basic goods.
So, Emiliana, what is it like then for you in the day-to-day, say, going to your local grocery shop?
So going grocery shopping in Caracas, which is where I live, has become a very surreal experience because there will usually be two lines at the checkout registers, one for people who are looking to spend their bolívares, the local currency, and another one for those who are paying in dollars. But because there is hyperinflation and it's compounded with a shortage of cash, and also our highest denomination bill is 50,000 bolívares, which is about $2. And people have very little cash available. Most people will pay using debit cards. But then again, we have electrical shortages. Sometimes the power will go out. So that's when things just really become unmanageable because there's no internet, there's no communications in order to be able to pay for basic goods that you're getting at an extremely overpriced markup. Right.
Yeah. And then there is actually this new class of elites emerging in Caracas called the plugged-in ones. Can you tell us more about them?
Right. That's a name that's being used locally, enchufados, which means those who are plugged in. And it refers to those people who, either through corruption or some sort of benefits in working with the government or any other illicit activities, have access to just vast amounts of wealth that the rest of the country doesn't, and are not ashamed to show it off. So it's become commonplace, especially in eastern Caracas, which is the more affluent part of the city. You can tell enchufado restaurants because it's usually steak houses that are lined with SUVs and security teams of these new oligarchs who have chosen to either have chosen or must stay in Venezuela because they have been sanctioned or barred from traveling into other countries and just spend their money, their inordinate wealth in just a very showy way.
Yeah. Yeah, this is such a huge contrast to the rest of the country. I mean, we've been reading some really harrowing reports from Venezuela's old oil capital in the northwest that there are grave robbers raiding coffins just to steal gold teeth fillings from the mouths of the dead. Just to hear this and in hear contrast of these very wealthy people, your reaction to this?
Well, you're right in that not only is there a disparity between people who have access to dollars and people who don't, but also people who live in Caracas and people who live in the rest of Venezuela. Maracaibo, the city you're describing, used to be the country's oil powerhouse. And now people go through the day in Maracaibo, sometimes with no power for up to 10 hours. I spoke to a friend in Maracaibo who says that he's not been on an elevator in the past year because he's scared. You never know when the power is going to go out. So he's scared to be stuck inside an elevator at any given point in time. It's a huge contrast, It's made it so that a lot of people in Maracaibo and other places around Venezuela who cannot emigrate, and it's up to 5 million people who have left the country so far, have chosen to come to Caracas because they just can't bear to get through the day inside the country. And what's unfortunate is that a government that championed the poor and came into power with a narrative of trying to lessen the income gap has now created basically a new elite, a new oligarchy that seems to be powering the economy in Venezuela.
So many people in survival mode, but I'm wondering, what are people saying about the politics? Has support for Maduro waned after all of this?
It's difficult to say, but last polls about 3 months ago put support for Maduro at around 20%. Why those popularity has been waning in the past few months, and I think it's pretty much attributed to political fatigue and people just impatience of wanting immediate results, and people are just not seeing them.
And you're a Guaido supporter.
I do believe that Guaido has a legitimate interpretation of the Constitution. I do believe that the elections last year that Maduro claims to have won were absolutely fraudulent.
We wanted to check in and touch base with you to get a deep sense of what's happening there, in part because we haven't heard about what's happening in Venezuela in many, many weeks and months. What would you like to see the international community do to help Venezuela?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I guess it's easy to write off Venezuela these days because the crisis is not as evident. But the fact that people in Venezuela are suffering and the country as a whole has pretty much gone on survival mode is still very much a reality. So the least I can ask the international community is to not write off Venezuela because it's worsening by the day.
Emiliana Duarte, freelance journalist and documentary filmmaker, currently working on a documentary called Time to Go about Venezuela's mass exodus. Emiliana, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
And here's a new service that officials hope will save lives.
This is an earthquake drill. Right now, drop cover and hold on.
What you just heard is California's first statewide earthquake warning system. It's the first of its kind in the nation, and it was launched Thursday. In fact, we were actually on air here at NPR West when the warning went out. This new Shake Alert app, as it's called, will give people who are likely to feel a 4.5 or larger earthquake up to 10 seconds to take cover or find a safe spot. And you know, it's no coincidence the system was launched yesterday. It was the 30th anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake. Many of you might remember that 6.9 earthquake erupted just before Game 3 of the World Series back in 1989. 63 people died, and who can forget those horrific photos of the Bay Bridge in San Francisco collapsing with cars falling in between the cracks. And now, we've just learned that there are signs that another big one could be coming soon. Researchers have discovered a major 160-mile-long fault line in the Mojave Desert, and it's moving for the first time in 500 years. The Garlock Fault is capable of producing a magnitude 8 earthquake, and it challenges a commonly held belief that major earthquakes rupture along a single large fault line. The Garlock Fault appears to have started moving after this summer's Ridgecrest earthquake, you might remember. A reminder for Californians that preparation is now more important than ever before.
And let's take a few minutes to make sense of the whirlwind that was the last 24 hours in Washington, and to answer a few questions that the recent developments have raised about the ongoing impeachment inquiry. NPR's national security editor, Phil Ewing, joins us now. Phil, it's good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Sure. And we know that you have some questions about the news this week. A lot of it happened behind closed door during the testimony on Capitol Hill in the impeachment inquiry. But then there were also some very public moments, like yesterday, when the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, said that there was indeed a quid pro quo in President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. And then he walked it back a few hours later. When you look back at the week that just passed, are you starting to see a clear picture emerge about how the Ukraine affair unfolded?
We are, and it's one of those situations that's very unusual in Washington because a lot of this story kind of just emerged basically fully formed in terms of the public understanding about it, although there is an investigation taking place in Congress, and although Democrats in the House say they want to learn more about what took place, they want to hear from other witnesses and get other documents. We basically know what this story is. The president had a program using some of his personal aides and using some official diplomats through the State Department to set up this outreach to the government of Ukraine that relied on doing things for him for his political campaign in 2020, the investigations the president wanted in exchange for engagement with him and continued assistance from the United States for Ukraine's military resistance against Russian and Russian-backed forces in the Crimea and in the East, which has been flowing from the United States since 2014. There are some questions, as you mentioned, that we don't have answers to now, but broadly, that's where the story is. The question is, what do people think about it, and what action, if any, should Congress take in response to it?
Well, and what about how involved President Trump himself was in developing the Ukraine strategy?
That's one of the key questions here. We know from accounts that we've gotten from witnesses directly through their written statements and also accounts given about their testimony to Congress, which has all been taking place behind closed doors, that Trump asked people in the State Department to deal with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, when they were dealing with Ukraine matters or European matters. And a lot of them were frustrated and upset by that. For one thing, according to some witnesses, they didn't agree with this policy of putting conditions in the way that Trump and Giuliani apparently wanted to on engagement with the United States. And also, they thought it was the province of professionals, National Security Council professionals, State Department professionals, to do this work, which is the way foreign policy typically has run in the United States. We have a State Department with missions overseas, with diplomats overseas, etc. And they resented the fact that this interloper, in their eyes, this aide to the president in Giuliani, had been given this portfolio that they thought should have belonged to them. What we don't know is what Trump was doing behind the scenes with Giuliani and with others, and how much of this has his personal fingerprints on it.
Phil, on the issue of Mick Mulvaney, the president defended his acting chief of staff today. He said that Mulvaney clarified his stance. But, you know, even some Republicans were pretty alarmed by what he said. Senator Lisa Murkowski said that it was absolutely a concern to hold up aid for a political reason. You know, he tried to walk it back, but either way, what kind of weight will those statements carry in the impeachment inquiry, if any?
Well, I think what Mulvaney did was take the White House and take some Republicans, although not all of them, as you mentioned, to a position which is going to be their landing zone in this Ukraine affair, which was the president has broad power to conduct foreign policy in the way he sees fit. In Mulvaney's telling, foreign policy, the conduct of national security, are always political. It always proceeds according to the political desires of the chief executive. And these national security pros and State Department diplomats and other pros that I talked about all work for him. And in Mulvaney's phrase, if they don't like it, if you don't like it, you need to get over it. And he was using his power as president to bring about the results that he wanted. What Mulvaney told reporters was, Obama did it one way, Trump is doing it this way, mm-hmm. and that's just the way the game is played in the big city. So the facts of the case are less material in this telling than whether you think that's appropriate and whether you think that the president should be impeached and removed from office. We haven't reached that stage in the game yet, but that's the way the story has been heading.
I know one of the other questions that you have this week is how much more investigating Democrats will do. Do you get the sense that they're almost done here?
I don't get that sense based on comments by the House Speaker and the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. They've said there's a lot more witnesses they want to hear from. They want to hear from some of the famous witnesses, John Bolton, the famous National Security Advisor, potentially Mike Pence, the vice president. We don't know if they'll actually appear, and there's a lot of documents they also want to get to. But there's a political dimension to this as well. Democrats are getting to a point where so much of this story has been established and is out in the open, they need to reach a decision about what they're going to do about it. Will they actually take a vote to initiate this House impeachment inquiry? They haven't done that yet because the Speaker believes she has that power just on her own from the Constitution. And then if they do, will they get to the point where they actually vote to impeach the president? That would be a huge deal. And we don't know yet whether they're playing for time or whether they actually believe there's more evidence that they can gather that will change people's minds, including the minds of the Senate Republicans, who they would need to actually remove Trump if we do get to that stage of impeachment.
And there will be more depositions scheduled for next week. So this was a very busy week. We'll see what happens in the week to come. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here Now.